Thank you for tuning in to Nevermore, four short stories by Edgar Allan Poe, adapted by Zachary Hemby, directed by Brenda C. Epley, produced by the Film and Theater Program at Harrisburg Area Community College. Sound effects designed and audio technology by Stephanie Finsterbush and Andrew Bowserman. Nevermore, Story 1, The Mask of the Red Death, narrated by Josh Arnold.
The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. For the victims, there were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution of the flesh. Once the scarlet stains appeared upon the victim's body, they became the pest ban that shut them out from the aid and sympathy of his fellow man.
Husband, look! Those are red blotches upon your face.
No, I am merely flushed. It is nothing more.
Children, come away from your father. We must flee at once.
What? No, it is nothing. Wait! Don't leave me here!
The whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. As with most pestilences, it had first appeared among the poor and destitute. Yet Prince Prospero, the ruler of that land, was unconcerned by this epidemic among his subjects. The prince drove through the streets in his carriage as his subjects heaped up piles of dead men, women, and children that the Red Death had already claimed. It was the faces of the corpses that were the most ghastly, locked into expressions of horror, besprinkled with blood.
As your advisor, I must tell you that this plague is ravaging your kingdom, sire. How should we confront it?
A plague among the poor does not trouble me. They live like rats, so it is no surprise that they have sickness among them.
What if it would spread to the wealthy? Your dominions are almost half depopulated already.
You are right. Something must be done.
So you will fight this pestilence?
Well, of course. I must quarantine myself until the Red Death has run its course. Even I could contract the sickness, for I am forced to come into contact with the lower classes from time to time, through servants and the like.
A quarantine would take months, and I know your fondness for opulent balls and galas.
I know. I will invite my friends to attend our quarantine as well. We will make it a grand celebration, a great ball. They will want to escape the pestilence of the streets as well. It will be a never-ending feast. You must arrange it all.
So, Prince Prospero summoned 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated palaces.
Come one! Come all! We will wait out this disease in style!
Prince Prospero's palace was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in, keeping out the undesirables. Crowds of the sick had gathered at the iron gates, crying vainly for any kind of mercy.
Can we do something about these whining peasants?
They are dying, sire.
Yes, I know. It is depressing. Can't they die somewhere else? I do not want my guests to be greeted by this pathetic display. Shoo them away.
We cannot go near them, or we will contract the disease.
Fine. but make sure none of them try to sneak onto the grounds. I won't have the Red Death spoiling my party. I specifically left him off the guest list.
One by one, rich carriages rolled through the gates, and once all the invited guests had arrived, the iron gates were heated and welded shut.
Is it all completed?
Yes, sire. There is no means of ingress or egress.
Egress? This is one of my parties. Who would ever want to leave? In fact, people are dying to get in. Do you get it? Dying to get in?
Good one, sire.
The vast palace had been amply provisioned for a month's long stay.
Thank you for the invitation, which is a fabulous idea, Prince. The moans of the dying wretches in the streets were beginning to sour my disposition.
Save us! Help us! Simply depressing.
Oh, I know. But enough of that talk. My celebration will have one rule. The outside world must be forgotten. We are safe inside, and that is all that matters. It is folly to grieve or to think.
For his guests, Prince Prospero had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, ballet dancers, and musicians. There was beauty, and there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. And so, 6 months passed.
Surely, the disease has run its course.
Actually, my prince, word is that the disease is now raging most furiously.
Then that means it must soon end. Let's celebrate. Summon all of the guests to a ball. I know. I am feeling lively. We will make it a masquerade, a masked ball, and I will host it in the Imperial Suite.
Sir, the Imperial Suite is so unnerving. Should you not have it in a different portion of the palace?
Of course it is unnerving. That is how I designed it. It will be perfect for my ghoulish gala.
So Prospero gave his 1,000 quarantined guests the wild pleasures of a revel so that they might forget the world outside, entertaining them with a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence.
Welcome to my ball. I have made masks for each and every one of you.
It was a voluptuous scene. The prince's own guiding taste gave character to the masqueraders' costumes and masks. Be sure, they were grotesque, disturbing and delirious illusions such as a madman fashions. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the 7 chambers of the Imperial Suite, there stalked a multitude of dreams.
Oh my! These masks are so grotesque.
Is there a problem? Perhaps you would enjoy spending the rest of your evening outside the palace grounds.
Oh, did I say grotesque? I meant gorgeous.
The Imperial Suite of Prospero's palace, in which the ball was to be held, was oddly designed. In many palaces, such suites form a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here, the case was very different, as might have been expected from Prospero's love of the bizarre. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one room at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn, a novel effect. As the ball began, the guests danced from room to room, their jubilant music carrying them on, and they gasped as they passed into each new room.
Wondrous! Look, the room seems to glow with light.
In the midst of each room, a tall and narrow Gothic window of stained glass emitted a colored light that matched the prevailing hue of the room. The room at the most eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows.
Ah, the color is new here.
The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. Now in no one of the seven apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum. There was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of the chambers.
Where do you suppose these colored lights come from?
Prospero told me his secret. There is a corridor that runs outside the windows of each room. There a tripod supporting a brazier of fire burns behind each of these windows, so that it glaringly illuminates the room.
It has an unsettling effect on me. Have you ever wondered, could the prince be deranged?
Shh! Do not say such things. Do you want us to get thrown out of this place?
Prince Prospero watched with a mad glee as his guests passed from room to room, in awe of the effect each presented. But it was their reaction to the final, most westward room that he anticipated.
Oh my! I do not like this room at all!
The seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon the black carpet. In this chamber only did the color of the windows fail to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color.
That red light! It's like the victims of the...
Shh! Don't speak its name.
In this black chamber, the effect of the firelight streaming in upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme. It produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within the area at all.
Let's leave at once. I cannot help that it reminds me of...
The prince appeared at the side of his guests, eyeing them strangely.
Reminds you of what?
Nothing. Nothing.
Prospero watched with a grin as the guests fled from the room in terror. He turned to the western wall of the black apartment, where there stood a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. When the minute hand made the circuit of the face and the hour was to be struck, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep, and exceedingly musical. All throughout the imperial suite, its striking could be heard. The clock made such a peculiar note that it caused the musicians of the orchestra to pause their performance momentarily to hearken to the sound. Also, the waltzers ceased their dancing, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole happy company, and even the giddiest guest grew pale.
That sound, it fills me with such dread.
Ignore it! Dance! Maestro, the music!
When the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly.
Now that it has faded, I do not know why that sound had such an effect on me.
Let's make a vow, The next time the clock chimes, it will not interrupt our merriment,
Yet after the lapse of 60 minutes, there came another chiming of the clock. It caused the same tremulousness and meditation as before.
Play on! Play on!
There was a madness about Prince Prospero. but none of his guests considered him to be mad. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. So the revel went whirlingly on. As the guests swirled from room to room, their colors changing gaily, the heart of life beating feverishly in the six rooms of the Imperial Suite. But none of them ventured into the black, most westward chamber, although it was always there in the back of their minds. How could they forget? Each hour, their dance was interrupted by the ebony clock. For a moment, the guests were stiff, frozen until the echoes of the chimes died away. Again, the music swelled. The guests lived again and writhed to and fro more merrily than ever. This process was repeated time and time again, and as the night slowly waned away, a ruddier light began to flow through the blood-colored panes of the westward room to complement the blackness of the sable draperies. At length, the sounding of midnight commenced upon the clock. The music and the waltzing stopped at once.
It would never stop.
Look there.
Before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, the guests became aware of the presence of a masked figure standing in their midst, which no one had noticed there before.
Who is that fellow? I could swear he was not standing there before.
Merciful heavens, look at his costume!
There arose from the whole company a buzz or murmur expressive of surprise, and then finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust.
That is in complete bad taste. Who is that rogue?
In an assembly of phantasms, no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited, but the figure in question had gone even beyond the mad imagination of Prince Prospero.
Some things should just not be joked about.
The guests had made a ring around the reveler in question. The figure was tall and gaunt and shrouded from head to foot in the trappings of the grave. The mask, which concealed the visage, was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the trick.
He looks like a corpse!
And yet all this might have been endured if his vesture had not been dabbled in blood and his broad brow and all the features of the face besprinkled with the scarlet horror.
Call for Prince Prospero. He must account for this fellow's costume. It is too ghastly.
When the prince arrived through the crowd of appalled partygoers, his face grew pale, but then reddened with anger.
What is the meaning of this, Prospero? He looks just like a corpse that has died from the...
Do not speak its name. I know what it looks like.
The prince, seething with rage, turned to the shrouded and masked guest.
Who dares...
You mean, this is not a costume of your design?
Not even I would think of a blasphemous mockery like this. Explain yourself at once, sir.
The mystery guest merely turned among the crowd, facing each reveler nearby with a slow and solemn movement that caused everyone present to shudder. The death-like face seemed to mock them with its bulging eyes.
Very well. If you will not speak, you villain, we will force you to. Seize him and unmask him at once.
No one moved toward the figure. All the guests were in mortal dread of it. The mocking corpse face turned from them, and with its ghost-like tread departed the blue, most eastward room it now occupied. The vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the rooms to the walls, and the figure made his way uninterruptedly.
Seize him! Stop him!
Ah! I would not touch that fiend for the life of me.
The crowd parted before the spectral image as it walked with the same solemn and measured step. It made its way through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green, through the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and then to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. The helpless prince and his advisors followed along behind.
Where is your bravery? Stop him! Seize him! Unmask this intruder!
Sire, if you wish to unmask that man, you must do it yourself.
The masked figure had at last crossed the threshold of the black, most westward room onto its velvet carpet. Then it turned, pointing its gruesome, grinning features toward the prince. The ticking of the ebony clock and the blood-red light from the window filled the room. The stranger's tall figure now stood within the shadow of the ebony clock. Prince Prospero stared into the final room with a wild mixture of emotions upon his face.
Fine. If none of you cowards will face him, I will.
The prince drew a knife from his belt and advanced into the dark chamber.
I will hang your dead body from the battlements of this palace at sunrise.
Maddened with rage, Prospero raised the knife above his head and charged the intruder. Yet the prince did not make it closer than 3 or 4 feet before he uttered a sharp cry of pain. The knife fell and lay gleaming upon the sable carpet. Prince Prospero lay there too, dead at the feet of that ghastly guest. The sight of this filled the other guests with courage, and they rushed into that room that had caused them so much dread.
Seize him! He has murdered the prince!
Yet, as many hands seized upon the costume of the stranger, the grave clothes and corpse-like mask, they found it empty of any tangible form. The costume fell limp in their grasp.
Ah! What is the meaning of this?
As they held up the empty costume, they stared at one another in unutterable horror.
Who was that man?
It was no man. It was the Red Death.
No! Impossible!
They looked down at the corpse of Prince Prospero. The oozing blood was there upon his brow, and his flesh looked soft and rotten.
There is its sign.
Ah!
The guests felt their own brows, which had gone clammy, and their own flesh, which felt weak. The Red Death was coming.
We must get out of here!
There is nowhere to go! We sealed ourselves in!
The Red Death was an uninvited guest, but he has come like a thief in the night!
So, one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel. Each died in the despairing posture of his fall. Then the life of the ebony clock went out with the last of the guests, and the flames of the tripods expired. Then darkness and decay and the Red Death held dominion over all.
The Mask of the Red Death, with voice acting provided by Ben Stansberry, Andrew Bowserman, Victoria Weber, Daytona Walsh, William Ziegler, and David Roberts. Nevermore, Story 2, The Fall of the House of Usher, narrated by Noah Euler.
During the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I had been passing alone on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country.
Surely I must be close.
Then I saw it. The House of Usher.
Whoa!
My first glimpse of the gloomy mansion was mirrored in the swamp-like lake that lay before it. I did not know how it was, but with the first glimpse of the mansion, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. An iciness, a sinking, a sickening of the heart.
What a melancholy place.
I tried to continue, but my horse was skittish.
Easy, girl. I fear this place, too. Just look at that foul water. Ugh.
Before the house were the dank and still waters of a black and lurid tarn. I stared upon the house's bleak walls, upon the vacant, eye-like windows, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees that surrounded it. It seemed that the house had soaked up all the evil and gloom of the surrounding countryside.
This sight brings my soul so low. I can only compare it to the afterdream of a reveler on opium. What is it about this house that unnerves me so?
I shook my head to ward off the feeling. Sometimes the sight of a very simple, natural object has the power to affect us in strange and unknown ways.
There is no reason to dread this house. I must go on.
To steady my nerves, I reached into the pocket of my jacket and pulled forth a letter. It was the same letter I'd received weeks ago, from the owner of the house that stood before me. A letter from my old friend, Roderick Usher. My eyes scanned over the words that had compelled me to undertake this journey.
My old friend, I request that you journey to see me. I have an illness of the body, an illness of the mind. I have an earnest desire to see you, my best and only friend. Perhaps your cheerful demeanor can alleviate my malady. This at least is my hope.
When I had received the singular summons, I had obeyed forthwith. Even at this, I could barely explain why I had answered his summons.
Why have I come here? Is it for Roderick? We were close friends in our boyhood, but I have not seen him in years. We are nearly strangers. But he considers us to be friends.
Roderick was the only descendant and heir to a vast family fortune. But the House of Usher was a sickly house that had never blossomed or branched.
All of the House of Usher has come down to him alone. I cannot leave a friend unaided in their time of need, no matter how distant they may be to me.
This, I resolved, and placing the letter back within my jacket, I continued up the causeway that led to the door of the family mansion. As I drew closer, I saw the age had greatly discolored the house. Fungi overspread the whole exterior, hanging in a fine, tangled webwork from the eaves of the house. The mansion itself was extraordinarily dilapidated. Although no part of the masonry had yet fallen, the individual stones showed their crumbling condition. In fact, a barely perceptible fissure extended from the roof down the wall in a zigzag direction until it became lost in the sullen waters of the tarn.
It is an ugly, malformed house. Well, there is no more avoiding it. I must go in.
I dismounted my horse and rapped heavily upon the front door of the manor. A pale-faced servant answered and seemed alarmed when he beheld me.
Who are you? What business do you have here, sir?
I have business with the master of the house, Roderick Usher.
Are you a doctor, then?
No, I am an old friend.
The mention of a friend seemed to strike the servant as odd, but he did not contradict me. He opened the door further, and I entered the Gothic archway of the hall. There, a valet appeared out of the gloom, and the two servants whispered together quickly.
Roderick Usher is expecting me.
Come this way. I will conduct you to the studio of the master.
The valet had led me into the dreariness of the house. To alleviate the oppressive silence, I felt the need to explain myself.
Roderick and I were friends at school, old chums. I have never been to his home. In fact, I know very little about his family. However, I do know the Ushers must be a wealthy family. A great line.
They are a broken line. A fractured house.
But the valet said no more as he conducted me in silence through many dark and intricate passages. Almost everything that I had encountered along the way heightened the vague horror that I felt growing within me. The carved ceilings, the somber wall tapestries, and the ebony blackness of the floors. Soon a figure appeared in the darkness of the hallway ahead, which I assumed to be Roderick himself.
Roderick!
But it was not he. It was a well-dressed man carrying a satchel, who stared at me with perplexity.
Who are you?
An old friend of the family. Who are you?
The family physician, sir.
Have you been able to help my friend?
There are some diseases beyond the scope of human effort. Good day.
As the physician passed on, I turned to the valet in confusion.
What do you suppose he meant by that?
The valet stared back at me without emotion.
The master is just through here.
The valet threw open a door and ushered me into a large and lofty room. The narrow pointed windows allowed feeble gleams of encrimsoned light through their panes, and dark draperies hung upon the walls. I felt that I breathed an atmosphere of sorrow.
You came!
Upon my entrance, Roderick Usher arose from a sofa on which he had been lying at full length and greeted me with a vivacious warmth.
Roderick, my old friend! When I received your letter, I came at once.
We seated ourselves, and I stared at Roderick Usher for a long period of time. No man had ever been so terribly altered as he. The robust boy I remembered from my childhood now had the complexion of a cadaver.
You are staring. Have I changed so much since the old days?
Of course not. I was only, it is good to see you.
Roderick attempted a smile and brushed his long hair back from his face. It had grown unheeded and seemed to float rather than fall about his features.
I am glad to see you as well, although I wish it were under finer circumstances. My health has continued to worsen.
I noticed that as Roderick spoke, his voice changed. Sometimes it was sullen, other times it was energetic. When it moved slowly, he reminded me of a drunkard, and when he spoke vivaciously, he reminded me of an eater of opium.
That is why I have summoned you. Perhaps you, my oldest friend, can give me some solace.
I met the doctor in the hallway. Has he been able to help you?
Roderick's face grew dark, and a nervous agitation seemed to seize him.
That fool! What does he know?
You are what I need. Then what is the source of this sickness, do you think?
Sickness? I would hardly call it that. It is a family evil. It will undoubtedly soon pass, and then all will be well.
Very well. Call it whatever you wish, but what are its symptoms?
My senses are affected by the tiniest things. I can only wear garments of certain textures. The smell of any flower oppresses my senses, and there are only a few sounds that do not inspire me with horror. My eyes are tortured by even a faint light. That is why I have the house so dark and dismal.
Ah, I noticed. It is not a lively place.
Suddenly he drew near me and grasped my arm violently.
I shall perish. I shall perish in this madness. I shall be lost.
I recoiled at the sudden whiteness and tremulousness of his face.
Good Lord, man, your face has gone pale.
I am a slave to this terror. It haunts me. I do not know what I fear, but I know this fear will force me to abandon my life and my reason altogether. Help me! You must!
Then Roderick fell senseless to the floor.
Valet! Quickly!
I summoned the servants to attend their master. They did not seem alarmed by his sudden fit of frenzy.
How long has your master been in this condition?
Years, sir.
Perhaps some fresh air would help him, although the sight of that ghastly lake outside is enough to sicken any man. Perhaps a stroll around the garden would do him some good.
The master does not go outside. He has not gone forth in years.
Years? Why ever not?
The servant did not reply. We laid him back upon his couch, and finally Roderick regained his senses, staring up at me with his large liquid eyes.
Forgive me. Forgive me, dear friend. Come close. I must whisper it. I will tell you the source of my disease.
I leaned in closely.
It is this house, the house that has done this to me. These gray walls and turrets, they have done this to me. It is warping me, bending me to its will.
You can't be serious. This is madness.
At the mention of madness, Roderick's eyes seemed to clear somewhat.
You are right. There is much weighing upon my mind. I did not tell you. Madeline is dying.
Madeline? Whom do you mean? Have you taken a wife?
A strange convulsion passed over his face as I asked this question.
Madeline, my dear sister.
Sister? Surely you jest. I did not even know you had a sister.
How odd that I would not mention one so dear to my heart. She is my last relative upon this earth. Her death will leave me the last of the ancient race of the Ushers.
Then she is ill as well?
Oh, yes, quite ill. Her illness has long baffled the doctors. She has slowly wasted away. It is her apathy for life. She no longer wishes to live. She wants to leave me alone here. Alone. Alone in this infernal house.
Calm yourself, friend. I find all of this so strange. How did I know nothing of this sister of yours?
Shh! Look!
His wild gaze strayed to the darkness of the hallway, where there hovered a figure in white. The sight of it nearly caused my heart to leap from my chest. It must have been the Lady Madeline. From her pale features mirrored that of her brother. I do not know why the sight of a maiden would cause me so much dread. She took no notice of us and passed back into the darkness of the hallway.
Was that Madeline?
I turned back to Roderick, but he had buried his face in his emaciated fingers and was sobbing uncontrollably.
Yes, God help me. That is she.
I cannot express how strange and horrifying these events were. The valet came and showed me to my chambers, and I was overjoyed that I saw the Lady Madeline no more, for her very presence caused me a fear I could not account for. Later that same evening, I was summoned back to Roderick's chamber, where with unusual calmness he told me some troubling news.
She has finally succumbed. The destroyer has claimed her.
Madeline is dead? But we saw her just this afternoon, walking.
That glimpse we had of her will be our last while she lives. Oh, heaven help me. She is gone.
For several days, Madeline's name was unmentioned by either Roderick or myself. During this period, I earnestly endeavored to alleviate the melancholy of my friend. We painted and read together, or I listened, as if in a dream, to the wild improvisations of his guitar.
I must strike the note somberly. A note too quickly struck will cause my senses to flare, and then I will fall faint.
The closer we became over these days, I came to recognize how darkness poured from Roderick's mind in one unceasing radiation of gloom. There is no cheering such a person. Although I can never forget the solemn hours I spent in the House of Usher, I cannot remember with great accuracy what occupied our time. A sulphurous luster settled over that time, and like the fungus that covered the house itself, blotted out all memory. One day, as he strummed one of his improvised dirges called The Haunted Palace, a tale of how a fair palace came to be inhabited by evil things, he stopped and stared at me strangely.
It's alive, you know.
What is?
This house. These stones.
Continue your song.
No, I am most adamant. The proof is my family. This house has molded the destiny of my family for centuries. It has made me what you see before you now.
I had no comment for these mad statements, so I made none. Among Roderick's library, he had many ancient volumes, but his chief delight was a curious volume, the manual of a long-forgotten monastery.
It tells the manner in which they did it, the monks, entombing the dead. In fact, it inspired me to do it to her.
Her? Whom do you mean?
Madeline, of course.
It was the first time he had spoken her name in days.
Her body is not yet buried. I plan to entomb it, at least for a fortnight.
Where?
Let me show you.
Bearing a torch, Roderick led me down into the bowels of the ancient house, wherein lay a stone vault. As he did, I remembered one of Roderick's dark paintings which had impressed me. It had been the image of a vault with no entrance or exit.
This vault lies directly beneath my sleeping chamber. See the walls? They are lined with copper.
Whatever for?
Once, centuries ago, this was used as a dungeon. Then it was used to store gunpowder. Now it will house Madeline.
Why should you keep her here?
To protect her from those doctors. They are curious to know her disease. They want her body. They want to know her secrets. But they will not have it. They will not!
Our conversation was interrupted by a pair of servants who arrived carrying a coffin upon their shoulders.
There she is. Sit her down here.
As we watched, the servants unscrewed the lid to the coffin. Roderick lifted it and looked upon the face of his sister's corpse. Her hair fanning out on either side to frame the gentle face. For the first time, I realized the striking similarity of features between Roderick and his sister.
She looks so much like you.
Did you not know? We are twins.
I looked up at him in shock. Never before had he mentioned this detail to me.
It is true, and there have always existed sympathies between us. Scarcely intelligible messages pass between our thoughts and feelings.
He stared down at the corpse, nearly mesmerized.
But that is all done now. This tomb is now her home.
He began to lift the coffin lid back into place.
Stay a moment. Look there. Her lips seem to be smiling, and her cheeks seem to have a blush.
It is nothing. Nothing. A corpse will play this trick from time to time. It is a symptom of her illness.
Unwilling to argue the point further, I watched as he screwed the coffin lid back into place. Then, as we left that copper-lined vault, he pulled the massive iron door shut to seal the room. With an enormous boom, the door was shut upon the sister of his bosom.
Farewell, sweet Madeline.
More days of grief passed in that gloomy house of Usher. Although I could not have imagined it, Roderick's countenance grew more and more ghastly pale as he wandered aimlessly from room to room. He seemed to be utterly lost in madness. As for myself, I felt the wild superstitions of my host creeping up on me. I began to eye the walls of the house with suspicion and fear. Its creaking and groaning began to appear as signs of breath and life, and its spirit began to affect my own soul. On the seventh night after placing Madeline in the tomb, I sat up in my bed, the terror of the house almost overpowering me. I could hear a tempest raging in the distance. The house was shifting and moaning all around me, and I went to my chamber door, opened it, and stared down to the dark hallway. A distant light appeared in the depths of the darkness. I do not know what I expect that light to be, but as it drew nearer, I saw that it was Roderick, bearing a lamp.
Have you seen it? Surely you have.
What?
He hurried into my chamber and led me to the window, where he threw it open to the elements. Outside, the clouds were hanging so low that they were pressing down upon the roof of the house.
Look there!
Out over the black waters of the tarn were glowing lights, floating in the thick, murky air.
No. No. No.
Do not fear such lights. They are an electrical phenomenon, a product of the storm. You have nothing to fear from them.
As I pulled Roderick away from the window and closed the chamber door, I picked up a book that happened to be lying there.
Here, let me read to you. Perhaps it will calm your nerves.
Nothing. Nothing can do that now.
Undeterred, I started to read to him. It was a medieval romance, a tale of Sir Lancelot, the brave knight. In the tale, the hero was breaking into the home of a hermit he had encountered.
So, the hero uplifted his mace and struck the wooden door so that it echoed all throughout the forest.
Just then, a noise from some remote part of the mansion came to my ears. It sounded just like the noise the story had described, splintering wood. Roderick lowered his head to his chest and began to rock back and forth.
No, no. No.
It is nothing, just a noise of the storm. Here, let us continue the story. To the knight's shock, the hermit's home was actually the den of a dragon. The knight uplifted his mace again and struck the head of the dragon. The beast then let out a horrid shriek.
Again I paused with wild amazement. In the distance had been the sound of screaming. Or had it been the grating of metal on stone? I looked at Roderick, but his eyes did not meet mine. They were firmly fixed upon the closed chamber doors, and his lips were muttering inaudible words. I continued, confident that this would overpower the dreadful sounds of the night.
The dragon breathed his fiery breath out at the knight, which caused him to drop his shield with a great and terrible ringing sound.
It was a distinct and hollow reverberation from deep within the house. My fear overpowered me, and I seized Roderick by his shoulders.
Ignore it. It is nothing.
For the first time, he looked up at me with a sickly smile.
Ignore it? How can I? Minutes, hours, days, I have heard these sounds day and night. How could I not hear them?
In my horror, I almost did not dare ask the question I felt welling up within me.
What are those noises? Is it the house?
It is Madeline. We have put her living in the tomb.
No, it cannot be.
Our senses are linked, hers and mine. So I heard her first feeble movements in the hollow coffin. Days ago, I dared not speak of it, but tonight? Tonight, with the dragon in the night, the rendering of her coffin, the grating of the iron hinges, the copper-lined vault, she will be here soon.
He grabbed madly at my shirt front.
Where shall I run? I have nowhere to go. She is coming to punish me for what I have done to her. Too soon! I buried her too soon!
He paused. And his eyes flicked wildly from side to side.
I hear her footsteps on the stairs. Ooh. I hear that heavy and horrible beating of her heart.
Here, Roderick sprang furiously to his feet and, nearing the closed chamber doors, shrieked out his syllable as if he were giving up his soul.
Madman! Madman! I tell you that she now stands behind the door!
As if his words had been a spell, the winds of the storm blew upon the chamber doors, causing them to fly open like a pair of black jaws. There did stand the enshrouded figure of Lady Madeline Usher, blood covering her billowing white robes. The evidence of some bitter struggle was upon every portion of her emaciated frame. For a moment she stood there trembling, reeling to and fro upon the threshold. Then a low, moaning cry escaped her lips. She fell heavily inward upon the person of her brother, and in her violent, final death agonies, bore him to the floor a corpse. Roderick was dead, the victim to the terrors he had anticipated. I could do nothing but flee from that mansion, aghast, dashing out into the storm. Its terrors were nothing compared to what I'd left behind. As I fled from the dreadful house down the road that had led me there, A wild light in the sky behind me caused me to turn. The moon was blood red, and it shone through the fissure that zigzagged from the house's roof to its base. While I gazed on, the cracks widened, and with a long, shouting sound like the voice of a thousand waters, the walls fell asunder. Then the deep and dark tarn at my feet closed sullenly and silently over the fragments of the House of Usher.
The Fall of the House of Usher, with voice acting provided by Ethan Hoffman, Andrew Bowserman, Josh Arnold, Charles Bellimo, Stephanie Vinsterbush, and William Ziegler. Nevermore, Story 3, The Raven, narrated by Sarah Murphy, David Roberts, and Daytona Walsh.
Once upon a midnight dreary,
while I pondered, weak and weary,
over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore,
while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping,
as of someone gently rapping,
rapping at my chamber door.
'Tis some visitor tapping at my chamber door. Only this, nothing more.
Ah, distinctly I remember. It was the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor.
Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow.
Sorrow for the lost Lenore.
Lenore.
For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels named Lenore.
Nameless here forevermore.
And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me.
Filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before.
So that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating.
'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more.
Presently, my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer.
Sir, or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you.
Here I opened wide the door.
Darkness. There. And nothing more.
Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing.
Doubting. Dreaming dreams no mortals ever dared to dream before.
But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token.
And the only word there spoken was the whispered word.
Lenore?
This I whispered.
And an echo murmured back the word.
Lenore? Lenore?
Merely this, and nothing more.
Back into the chamber, turning, all my soul within me burning.
Soon again, I heard a tapping somewhat louder than before.
Surely, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what there is, in this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more.
Open here, I flung the shutter.
When, with many a flirt and flutter,
in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore.
Not the least obeisance made he.
Not a minute stopped or stayed he.
But with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door.
Perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door.
perched and sat, and nothing more.
Then, this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling.
By the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore.
Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou art sure no craven. Ghastly grim and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me, what thy lordly name is on this night's Plutonian shore?
Quoth the raven,
Nevermore.
Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly.
Though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore.
For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being
ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door.
Bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door.
With such name as Nevermore.
But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only
that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour.
Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered,
till I scarcely more than muttered.
Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before.
Then the bird said,
Nevermore.
Startled at the stillness, broken by reply so aptly spoken.
Doubtless what it utters is its only stock and store. Caught from some unhappy master, whom unmercifully disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, to the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore.
But the raven, still beguiling all my fancy into smiling.
Straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door.
Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking.
Fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore.
What this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore.
This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing.
To the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core.
This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease, reclining.
On the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er.
But whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore.
Then, methought, the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer.
Swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor.
Wretch! Thy God hath lent thee, by the angels he hath sent thee, respite! Respite and nepenthe from thy memory of Lenore. Quaff, oh quaff, this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore.
Quoth the raven,
Nevermore.
Prophet, thing of evil, prophet still. If bird or devil, whether tempter sent, or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate, yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore.
Quoth the raven,
Nevermore.
Nevermore. Prophet, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by the God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Eden it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels named Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels named Lenore.
Quoth the raven,
Nevermore.
Ah! Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend. Ah!
I shrieked, upstarting.
Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door.
quoth the raven,
"Nevermore."
And the raven, never flitting,
Still is sitting.
On the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door.
And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming.
And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor.
And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor
shall be lifted.
Never.
The Raven, with voice acting provided by Charles Bellamo, Sarah Murphy, and Noah Euler. Nevermore, Story 4, The Black Cat, narrated by Billy Mortel.
For the most wild, yet most homely narrative which I am about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it. It is a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad am I not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburden my soul. From my infancy I was noted for the docility of my disposition. My tenderness of heart was even so conspicuous as to make me the jest of my companions. I was especially fond of animals, and was indulged by my parents with a great variety of pets. With these I spent most of my time, and never was so happy as when feeding and caressing them. This peculiarity of character grew with my growth, and in my manhood I derived from it one of my principal sources of pleasure. I married early, and was happy to find in my wife a disposition not uncongenial with my own. Observing my partiality for domestic pets, she lost no opportunity of procuring those of the most agreeable kind. We had birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat.
Oh, my dear husband, I'm so happy that you love animals as much as I do. There is no home more blissful than one filled with pets.
Our cat was a remarkably large and beautiful animal, entirely black and sagacious to an astonishing degree. In speaking of his intelligence, my wife, who at heart was not a little tinctured with superstition, made frequent allusions to the ancient popular notion which regarded all black cats as witches in disguise.
Pluto is so intelligent. Look how he watches us. It makes me think of that old superstition that black cats are witches in disguise. What a silly idea.
Not that she was ever serious upon this point. And I mention the matter at all for no better reason than that it happens just now to be remembered. Pluto, this was the cat's name, was my favorite pet and playmate. I alone fed him, and he attended me wherever I went about the house. It was even with difficulty that I could prevent him from following me through the streets.
No, Pluto, you must stay here. Your master must go about his business. Oh, husband, how Pluto loves you!
Our friendship lasted in this manner for several years, but then the fiend intemperance crept into my life. I drowned myself in alcohol, and my general temperament and character experienced a radical alteration for the worse. I grew day by day more moody, more irritable, more regardless of the feelings of others.
Darling, what is the matter? You have never spoken to me in this manner before. Have you been to the tavern?
I suffered myself to use intemperate language to my wife. At length, I even offered her personal violence.
No, I don't understand. You have changed.
My pets, of course, were made to feel the change in my disposition. I not only neglected, but ill-used them. For Pluto, however, I still retained sufficient regard to restrain me from maltreating him, as I made no scruple of maltreating the rabbits, the monkey, or even the dog when by accident or through affection they came in my way. But my disease grew upon me, for what disease is like alcohol? At length even Pluto, who was now becoming old and consequently somewhat peevish, even Pluto began to experience the effects of my ill temper. One night, returning home much intoxicated, from one of my haunts about town, I fancied that the cat avoided my presence. I seized him, when in his fright at my violence he inflicted a slight wound upon my hand with his teeth. Ah! The fury of a demon instantly possessed me. I knew myself no longer. I took from my waistcoat pocket a penknife, opened it, grasped the poor beast by the throat, and deliberately cut one of its eyes from the socket. I blush. I burn. I shudder when I pen the damnable atrocity. When reason returned with the morning, when I had slept off the fumes of the night's debauch, I experienced a sentiment half of horror, half of remorse, for the crime of which I had been guilty. But it was, at best, a feeble feeling, and the soul remained untouched. I again plunged into excess and soon drowned in wine all memory of the deed. In the meantime, the cat slowly recovered. The socket of the lost eye presented a frightful appearance, but he no longer appeared to suffer any pain. He went about the house as usual, but as might be expected, fled in extreme terror at my approach. I had so much of my old heart left as to be at first grieved by this evident dislike on the part of a creature which had once so loved me. But this feeling soon gave place to irritation, and then to a spirit of perverseness. I believe this is one of the primary sentiments of man, who has not 100 times found himself committing a vile or silly action for no other reason than because he knows he should not. This spirit of perverseness, I say, came to my final overthrow.
Darling, darling, what are you doing to the cat?
One morning, in cool blood, I slipped a noose about the cat's neck and hung it to the limb of a tree, hung it with a tear streaming from my eyes and with the bitterest remorse in my heart, hung it because I knew that it had loved me and because I felt it had given me no reason of offense, hung it because I knew that in so doing I was committing a sin. On the night of the day on which this cruel deed was done, I was aroused from sleep by the cry of fire.
Fire! The house is on fire!
The curtains of my bed were in flames. The whole house was blazing. It was with great difficulty that my wife, a servant, and myself made our escape from the conflagration. The destruction was complete. My entire worldly wealth was swallowed up, and I resigned myself thenceforward to despair.
What shall we do? We have nothing in the world, nothing.
I am above the weakness of seeking to establish a sequence of cause and effect between the disaster and my crime, but I am detailing a chain of facts and wish not to leave even a possible link imperfect. On the day succeeding the fire, I visited the ruins. I found a dense crowd gathered about the ruins, examining them. The walls, with one exception, had fallen in. This exception was found in a compartment wall, not very thick, which stood about the middle of the house, and against which had rested the head of my bed. The wall's plastering had resisted the action of the fire, a fact which I attributed to its having been recently spread.
Strange! Look at that shape there on the wall!
How singular! It looks like a cat!
As if graven in bas-relief upon the white surface of the wall, was the figure of a gigantic cat. The impression was given with an accuracy truly marvelous. There was a rope about the animal's neck. When I first beheld this apparition, my wonder and my terror were extreme. But at length reflection came to my aid. The cat, I remembered, had been hung in a garden adjacent to the house. Upon the alarm of fire, this garden had been immediately filled by the crowd, by someone of whom the animal must have been cut from the tree and thrown through an open window into my chamber. This had probably been done with a view of arousing me from sleep. The falling of other walls had compressed the victim of my cruelty into the substance of the freshly spread plaster, the lime of which, with the flames and the ammonia from the carcass, had then accomplished the image as I saw it.
A cat? You saw the image of a cat? Are you sure? What could that mean?
For months, I could not rid myself of the phantasm of the cat. During this period, there came back into my spirit a half-sentiment that seemed, but was not, remorse. I went so far as to regret the loss of the animal and to look among the vile haunts which I now habitually frequented for another pet of the same species and of somewhat similar appearance with which to supply its place.
You again. What'll it be? The usual? Pint of ale?
One night, as I sat half-stupefied in a den of more than infamy, my attention was suddenly drawn to some black object reposing upon the head of one of the immense hogshead barrels of rum. I had been looking steadily at the top of this barrel for some minutes, and what now caused me surprise was the fact that I had not sooner perceived the object thereupon. I approached it and touched it with my hand. It was a black cat, a very large one, fully as large as Pluto, and it closely resembling him in every respect but one. Pluto had not a white hair upon any portion of his body, but this cat had a large, though indefinite, splotch of white covering nearly the whole region of the breast. Upon my touching him, he immediately arose, purring loudly, rubbed against my hand, and appeared delighted with my notice. This, then, was the very creature of which I was in search. I at once offered to purchase it of the landlord.
That cat? Never seen it before. Don't allow cats in here anyway. Take it with you.
When I prepared to go home, the animal evinced a disposition to accompany me. I permitted it to do so, occasionally stooping and patting it as I proceeded. When it reached the house, it domesticated itself at once and became immediately a great favorite with my wife.
Oh, dear! It looks so much like Pluto! Here is one brief spot of joy in all our misery.
For my own part, I soon found a dislike to it arising within me. This was just the reverse of what I had anticipated. By slow degrees, these feelings of disgust and annoyance rose into the bitterness of hatred. I avoided the creature. A certain sense of shame and the remembrance of my former deed of cruelty prevented me from physically abusing it. I did not for some weeks strike or otherwise violently ill-use it, but gradually, very gradually, I came to look upon it with unutterable loathing, and to flee silently from its odious presence as from the breath of a pestilence. What added no doubt to my hatred of the beast was the discovery on the morning after I brought it home that, like Pluto, it also had been deprived of one of its eyes. This circumstance, however, only endeared it to my wife.
Oh, the poor thing! It has been wounded!
With my aversion to this cat, however, its partiality for myself seemed to increase. It followed my footsteps with a pertinacity which it would be difficult to make the reader comprehend. Whenever I sat, it would crouch beneath my chair or spring upon my knees, covering me with its loathsome caresses. If I arose to walk, it would get between my feet and thus nearly throw me down. At such times, although I longed to destroy it with a blow, I was yet withheld from so doing, partly by a memory of my former crime, but chiefly, let me confess it at once, by absolute dread of the beast. This dread was not exactly a dread of physical evil, and yet I should be at a loss how otherwise to define it. I am almost ashamed to own, yes, even in this felon's cell, I am almost ashamed to own that the terror and horror with which the animal inspired me had been heightened by a strange event. My wife had called my attention more than once to the character of the mark of white hair of which I have spoken, and which constituted the sole visible difference between the strange beast and the one I had destroyed. This mark, although large, had been originally very indefinite, but by slow degrees nearly imperceptible, it had assumed a rigorous distinctness of outline. It was now the image of the gallows. During the day, the creature left me no moment alone, and in the night I started hourly from dreams of unutterable fear. To find the hot breath of the thing upon my face, and its vast weight, an incarnate nightmare that I had no power to shake off eternally upon my heart. Beneath the pressure of torment such as these, the feeble remnant of the good within me succumbed. Evil thoughts became my sole intimates. The darkest and most evil of thoughts, the moodiness of my usual temper increased to hatred of all things and of all mankind.
Why are you so cruel to me? Don't you have a soul?
One day my wife accompanied me upon some household errand into the cellar of the old building which our poverty compelled us to inhabit. The cat followed me down the steep stairs, and nearly throwing me headlong, exasperated me to madness. Uplifting an axe and forgetting, in my wrath, the childish dread which had hitherto stayed my hand, I aimed a blow at the animal, which, of course, would have proved instantly fatal had it descended as I wished. But this blow was arrested by the hand of my wife. Goaded by the interference into a rage more than demoniacal, I withdrew my arm from her grasp and buried the axe in her brain. She fell dead upon the spot without a groan. This hideous murder accomplished, I set myself forthwith to the task of concealing the body. I knew that I could not remove it from the house, either by day or by night, without the risk of being observed by the neighbors. Many projects entered my mind. At one period, I thought of cutting the corpse into minute fragments and destroying them by fire. At another, I resolved to dig a grave for it in the floor of the cellar. Again, I deliberated about casting it in the well in the yard, or I thought of packing it in a box as if merchandise with the usual arrangements, and so getting a porter to take it from the house. Finally, I hit upon what I considered a far better expedient than either of these. I determined to wall it up in the cellar, as the monks of the Middle Ages are recorded to have walled up their victims. For a purpose such as this, the cellar was well adapted. Its walls were loosely constructed and had largely been plastered through with a rough plaster, which the dampness of the atmosphere had prevented from hardening. Moreover, in one of the walls was a projection caused by a false chimney or fireplace that had been filled up and made to resemble the red of the cellar. I made no doubt that I could readily displace the bricks at this point, insert the corpse, and wall the hole up as before, so that no eye could detect anything suspicious. And in this calculation, I was not deceived. By means of a crowbar, I easily dislodged the bricks, and having carefully deposited the body against the inner wall, I propped it in that position while I relaid the whole structure as it originally stood. Having procured mortar, sand, and hair with every possible precaution, I prepared a plaster which could not be distinguished from the old, and with this I very carefully went over the new brickwork. When I had finished, I felt satisfied that all was right. The wall did not present the slightest appearance of having been disturbed. The rubbish on the floor was picked up with the minutest care. I looked around triumphantly and said to myself, "Here at least, then, my labor has not been in vain." My next step was to look for the beast which had been the cause of so much wretchedness, for I had firmly resolved to put it to death. Had I been able to meet with it at the moment, there could have been no doubt of its fate. but it appeared that the crafty animal had been alarmed at the violence of my previous anger and forbore to present itself in my present mood. It is impossible to describe or to imagine the deep, blissful sense of relief which the absence of the detested creature occasioned in my bosom. It did not make its appearance during the night, and thus for one night at least since its introduction into the house, I soundly and tranquilly slept. Yes, slept, even with the burden of murder upon my soul. The second and third day passed, and still my tormentor came not. Once again I breathed as a free man. The monster, in terror, had fled the premises forever. I should behold it no more. My happiness was supreme. The guilt of my dark deed disturbed me but little. Some few inquiries had been made by those who frequented our streets, but these had been readily answered.
I have not seen your wife about. Is she well?
Even a search had been instituted, but of course nothing was to be discovered. I looked upon my future felicity as secured. Upon the fourth day of the assassination, a party of police came very unexpectedly into the house and proceeded again to make rigorous investigation of the premises.
We would just like to have a look around. Standard practice, you know.
Secure, however, in the inscrutability of my place of concealment, I felt no embarrassment whatever.
You may come with us and show us around.
The officers bade me accompany them in their search. They left no nook or corner unexplored. At length, for the third or fourth time, they descended into the cellar. I quivered not in a muscle. My heart beat calmly, as that of one who slumbers in innocence. I walked the cellar from end to end. I folded my arms upon my bosom and roamed easily to and fro. The police were thoroughly satisfied and prepared to depart. The glee at my heart was too strong to be restrained. I burned to say, if but one word by way of triumph, and to render doubly sure their assurance of my guiltlessness.
Gentlemen, I delight to have allayed your suspicions. By the by, gentlemen, this is a very well-constructed house.
In the rabid desire to say something easily, I scarcely knew what I uttered at all.
Yes, it is an excellently well-constructed house. These walls are solidly put together.
Then I rapped heavily with a cane which I held in my hand upon the very portion of the brickwork behind which stood the corpse of the wife of my bosom. But may God shield and deliver me from the fangs of the arch-fiend. No sooner had the reverberation of my blows sunk into silence than I was answered by a voice from within the tomb. It was a cry, at first muffled and broken like the sobbing of a child, and then quickly swelling into one long, loud, and continuous scream. A howl. A wailing shriek, half of horror and half of triumph, such as might have arisen only out of hell. Of my own thoughts it is folly to speak. Swooning, I staggered to the opposite wall. For one instant the party upon the stairs remained motionless through extremity of terror and of awe. In the next, a dozen stout arms were toiling at the wall.
Tear it down! The sound came from behind the wall.
No! No! The wall fell bodily. The corpse, already greatly decayed and clotted with gore, stood erect before the eyes of the spectators. Upon its head, with red extended mouth and solitary eye of fire, sat the hideous beast whose craft had seduced me into murder and whose informing voice had consigned me to the hangman. I had walled the monster up within the tomb!
We thank you for joining the audio podcast of Nevermore, four stories by Edgar Allan Poe, adapted by Zachary Hemby, and presented by the Film and Theater Program at Harrisburg Area Community College. Special thanks to Almazric Mengesu for audio introduction.